All right, the mics are open.
Okay. Good morning. This is Julie Fedorchak with the North Dakota Public Service Commission. It is about 9:05. We are starting a work session on NSP Electric Annual Reports. We'll be broadcasting this session, and the cases involved in this are case number PU 12-811, 13-209, 14-589, 14-745, 14-746, and 14-754. Those are the annual reports relating to NSP from 2011 to 2014, as well as annual reports for MDU and Otter Tail for 2014.
Hey, guys. Brian here.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, sorry for the delay. I thought you guys were calling in me, but it's no problem. This works easy, too.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so we all heard Brian Kulk is on the road and calling in, so thank you, Brian, for doing that. We also have Commissioner Christman here, and I'll turn over here him for any opening remarks in a second, and you as well, Brian. But I appreciate staff, the work staff has done on analyzing the annual reports. It's a requirement. I don't have a lot of history here at the commission, but since I've been here, I know that the annual report analysis has been filed, but we haven't spent a lot of time talking about it together. And I think there's some really good information in this particular analysis that I thought merited some additional discussion and conversation amongst us as well as staff. And if the company, I know that Dave Cedarquist is on the phone, if the company has additional things to provide, I think in this case, although we don't usually do that, on our work sessions, I think I'm open to having Dave Cedarquist offer input if there are some perspectives that he wants to offer that aren't being represented through staff and what staff is presenting. So with that, I will open it up to comments from, we'll go to Randy first since he's here, and then we'll catch you on the phone, Brian. Randy, any thoughts?
I do not have any opening
Okay,
comments.
Very good. Brian, any opening comments as the portfolio holder on this one?
Sure. Well, just to supplement what you said, Julie, just thank you for setting this up. And I think it's very important that we go through what you're talking about, go through those reports, because, you know, I've long since felt that there's a tail to all this development in North Dakota where, you know, we're out there, we're approving power lines, and we've got wind farms, and we've got rate cases, and, you know, there's a reason for all these costs going up. And I think it's twofold. One is the companies are having to build new things because things are getting old, you know, like transmission lines, but they're having to make tough choices on generation. So I think it's really good to go through this just like we're doing today, and I appreciate Mike's analysis and everyone else, because we're going to get a lot more questions why these rates have been trending up. I think we need to understand exactly how much of it is because of environmental regulation, how much is it to replace old facilities, and how much of it is that people need to get paid more for their jobs and those kind of things, cost of construction. So I'll probably just listen in. I went through Mike's slides pretty thorough last night, and I don't think I have a lot of questions. I just appreciate the analysis.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. I agree with you that this is a really good chance for us to better understand it so we can better share that information with the public and communicate what's going on and also provide, you know, any ideas on what we might expect ahead. So with that, I think we'll turn it over to Mike to walk through. He has a PowerPoint presentation here that he's going to walk through with a lot of great charts and graphs. And I think we can just have a free flow discussion with Mike. If anybody has questions, just jump in. Before we get started with that, though, we should go around the room. You heard from Randy and I. We'll go around the room and talk who else is here, and then we can also mention who's on the phone. So I'll turn it to you first, Mike.
Mike Diller.
John Hsu.
Victor Shook.
Sarah Cardwell.
And Patrick Fawn.
Jerry Leon.
Alana Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Okay, and then on the phone from NSP?
Yes, this is Dave Cedarquist with NSP. Thank you.
All right. Very good. Very good. Is there anyone else on the line? Okay. All right, so we know who's participating, and we'll just move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, and good morning. Okay.
Brian, can you hear?
Can you hear me all right, Brian?
Yep, I can hear it fine as long as you guys stay tight to the mode. If there's a delay, it's always got to take off my own mute. But, no, I hear it great.
Okay. The very first slide is just a it's the cost of electricity delivered to residential customers. And this includes, of course, the city municipalities, the co-ops, the investor-owned utilities. We have 36 entities that provide electricity in North Dakota, and we regulate three of those. But this gives you an idea. Statewide, you'll notice when we go through these slides, we start at the very top, and then we kind of zero in on the investor-owned utilities that we regulate. But so from a macro view, we have the second lowest rates for residential customers, according to the U.S. Energy and Information Administration. That is as of 2014, the full year 2014. They don't have full year 2015 available yet. They do have monthly rates that you can look at that are newer than that, but I prefer to look at an entire year when I look at averages like this. So we are the second lowest rate in the country.
About 9 cents per kilowatt compared to the U.S. 12 point something?
Yeah, 12 something, right.
What state is the lowest?
Pardon?
What state is the lowest?
Yeah, I think it was Idaho, perhaps, but I don't recall exactly.
But then if you look back on this chart, what I find interesting is as in 2002, we were at less than 7 cents per kilowatt hour. So we've gone up 2 cents per kilowatt hour in the last. That's pretty
big change. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now this is residential. The next one's industrial customer comparison. And here we rank 35th out of 51 states counting D.C., which is a little alarming since the industrial rates, as you were pointing out with the residential class, Julie, back in the 2002-04 area, we looked very favorable to the other states around us and to the overall U.S. average. Since we only regulate three of the entities reporting, I can only guess as to what might be driving this, and I'm wondering if it isn't the oil patch build out and what the co-ops might be charging industrial customers out in the oil patch. It'd just be a guess on my part, but we will see that our industrial rates, you can just see right here that it's been one of these long-term running arguments in rate design cases. Jerry Lean and before Jerry Lean, the basic principle around here is we don't adjust customer classes. We don't. If you have a 6% increase, no customer class gets less than 3%, and no customer class pays more than 9 cents or 12 cents. Is it double or 1.5? Times, Jerry. Okay, 1.5. And when you do that, and you have a big difference between residential and industrial rates, it takes a long time for that to straighten itself out. But
go ahead, Randy.
Well, just to be clear, this is all residential and all industrial, not just the regulated.
Right. This counts. This includes the co-ops. Okay. Yep.
And this shows that since 2003-ish, they have almost doubled from 4 cents to 7.5.
Right.
And, you know, I could add to that.
You need a mic, though, Jerry.
So if you look back at our rate cases that have been filed over the last 10 years or so, we have had a movement in our rate design towards giving the industrial class less of the increases. And so I think for our investor-owned utilities, I don't know, that to me it doesn't look like we've doubled our rates over the last 10 years.
Is that a comparison we could look at?
Yeah. So we've done more for the residential rates have grown more, I think, lately than the industrial.
Let me just throw a quick chime in on that one. When Jerry talked about there's been a movement, I don't think it was a shift on so much on commissioner policy, but I think back to the Otter Trail rate case where we had interveners, organized interveners on behalf of the large industrial group, that the when we have rate cases that are filed that they get too squirrely with large industrial group, they're starting to intervene and weigh in heavy, and that's what happened in that Otter Trail case, or the Otter Trail case.
Okay. The next slide is, thanks guys for that input. The next slide is average cost of electricity, all classes combined, and we come in 11th in the country in 2014, well below the U.S. average of looks like about 11 cents. We're closer to 9 cents. The next chart, now we start focusing a little bit in our own state. And I guess I'll talk about the first line first, the number of reporting entities. Back in 2004, 5, and 6, all of the entities providing electricity in North Dakota were providing information to the Energy Information Administration. In about 2012, a lot of the city municipalities and the high-priced co-ops decided not to provide information anymore. At least that's my take. It's not available on EIA's website. And so I don't know if it's because of these comparisons I've been doing or why. But I think this is still a very relevant and important chart to look at because of the entities falling off the reporting, the city municipalities were the cheapest, and the co-ops that fell off were, for the most part, the most expensive. So if you were to draw a line in your chart, I did freehanded, but and you put in their median point for ranking purposes, I think this is still very relevant. And so let's just take one for example. Northern States Power Company in 2004 was 12th out of 36 reporting entities. Today, they're 17th out of 23. And so that's just a little bit disconcerting. Montana Dakota, on the other hand, they were 25th out of 36 entities reporting. Today, they're 10th out of 23. And so I think it's still a useful chart, even though the number of reporting entities have changed. Any questions on that one? Okay. The next chart. Is simply retail revenues divided by retail sales. All retail revenues divided by all retail sales. And so all the classes are included in this analysis. And what you see here is NSP was one of the cheapest electric providers back in 2003 at 5.5 cents, and now they're at 9 cents in 2014. On the other hand, Otter Tail was at 6 cents, and today they're at 8 cents. And so you can see why I wrote what I did in my memo, that if we continue down this path, NSP continues down this path, we're going to have more and more concerns as time goes on, and the company needs to understand that, and they do, but we can't take our foot off the brake pedal, so to speak. So the next one is a comparison of the three IOUs' residential rates. Here you see NSP's rates quite a bit higher than MDU and Otter Tail right now. Some of that is because, well, we'll get to that in a little bit, but MDU and Otter Tail's rates are kind of running along together for the most part. This one's a really interesting one. The next chart on small commercial industrial rates, while NSP's rates are overall quite a bit higher than Otter Tail and MDU, here we see MDU's small commercial industrial rates are, in fact, the highest cost rates, and so the highest rates. And you see that in the next chart as well for the large commercial and industrial customers. We were talking about, you know, are the large industrial rates changing for the IOUs like they are overall with all of the electric providers? And here you can see that NSP's rates were close to 4 cents in 2003, and today they're at close to 7.5 cents. The good story, if there was one here, is that Otter Tail's rates were 5 cents, and today they're 7 cents. So there has been quite an increase.
Go ahead. Otter Tail.
The green line?
Oh, oops, I must be on the wrong chart. Small commercial and industrial?
Moving. Yeah, I've been moving
large.
Fast.
Sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. I want to get to.
Got it.
Okay. Now, the next slide just shows, you know, why are NSP's rates increasing at a higher rate than Otter Tail and MDU? Well, it's largely because of all their refurbishments of their expensive generating plants and transmission investments, and so that's causing them to file rate increases. And so this chart just shows that NSP has had a rate increase every year since 2010. In comparison to, let's say, MDU had one in 2011, 2003, and then the last one was back in 1987. Otter Tail, 2009, the previous one was 1982. Now, that is not to say that they haven't had other rate increases, because we have lots of riders, and for all practical purposes, riders have started to replace rate increases. So we have riders for generation facilities, for transmission facilities, for fuel costs, renewable rider for wind farms, and so you wouldn't expect as many rate increases maybe when companies are allowed to flex their rates for large projects.
So to that question, do you, for NSP, since they've been having general rate increases, they also have renewable rider, fuel costs, and transmission rate.
You're
so they
right.
Have all of those.
But to be fair, NSP's been—they've come to the party late as far as the use of riders. Otter Tail's had their wind rider for 8 years. NSP has just entered into that phase of using a renewable rider. They've been a little late in coming to the party. Yeah. And they don't have a generation rider like Otter Tail and MDU does.
Could you chart that, the riders? Could you add a line on here for riders that shows like how those have changed?
That'd be a lot of work. But
Would it?
Anything can be done. But I don't have that done. I don't have that information. But it could be done. Yeah, it would be a lot of work. Okay. The next slide is just to show you, in particular with NSP Electric, their earnings. Their earnings have only breached 10% once since 2008, which is probably a fairly reasonable place to be, a 10% return on equity. And so while their rates are higher and have moved quite a bit higher, they are not over-earning. And now they have a rate moratorium in effect until 2018 as a result of a couple of settlements. And so, they're going to have to be careful over the next couple of years in order to earn a reasonable return on their investment in North Dakota.
What happened in 2010 with the 2%?
you know, that is outside of that's outside of this report. I'll bet you that I addressed that in the last report,
okay,
which did cover 2010. When you see something that bad in this case, it makes you wonder what the weather was like in that 2010 period, because weather can have a fairly significant impact. And maybe Dave Cedarquist, he's on the line, maybe he can remember 2010 when you guys reported earnings of 2%. Dave, do you?
I don't recall what it was right now, but I'll definitely follow up on that and get some information back to the commission.
Okay, well, that's okay. I can do that as well, Dave. You got more important stuff to do in Minneapolis today, so I'll take care of that. Okay, next graph just shows you, it's always nice to kind of figure out, well, what's included in these costs that we charge customers. A good bit of the cost is production expense, which includes fuel costs and purchase power costs, two very big costs in the electric business. Then you've got the next biggest one is cost of capital, which is, it's not just the cost of money, it's the cost of money applied to the investment that is necessary to provide service. So you have just those two alone make up about two-thirds of the cost. Depreciation, of course, we know what that is. But and then what I do is I take that pie and I throw it up there on a per kilowatt hour basis so that we can see, on average, let's just work with the middle post there, NSP. On average, NSP's overall rates, if they were to earn a 10% ROE, would be just a little above 9 cents a kilowatt hour. And so of that 9 cents, 4 cents comes from production expense. Now, I've got some slides that are going to cause us to go into the weeds just a little bit with production expense, so I'm not going to address why that difference is just yet. But if we work our way up the post there, the next one's cost of capital. You know, those look similar. Depreciation's pretty similar. Transmission, pretty similar. Admin in general is really sticks out there. Otter Tails looks like their admin in general on a kilowatt hour basis is, you know, nearly twice what MDUs and NSPs is. And I have two thoughts on that. One is that if you think about the size and scope of those other two companies, NSP and MDU, they have a lot of different. They have lots of additional customers to allocate fixed costs over, and MDU has a lot of different companies to allocate administrative costs over. So, I think it's more just a Otter Tail's a very small company, and they've gotten smaller because they've been going back to their core business of providing electricity as opposed to being in the potato business or the baseball business or things of that nature. And so they just have fewer units to spread those costs over. And so I think it's an economy of scale thing. The other thought I would give you is I also think that because they've been selling off their non-utility businesses and going back to their core business, I think that's part of the reason, too, is you just don't have other business entities to spread those costs over. And I'm hoping to see this box of Otter Tails get a little smaller. I think sometimes it takes a little while for corporate to readjust its size to a shift in how they're doing business. And so I guess I'm hopeful that the Otter Tail box, even though I don't expect them ever to probably have a smaller box than NSP or MDU, I'm hoping that they can contract that box just a little bit as corporate readjusts itself to the kind of business that it's in. The next one, income tax expense. NSP has a big box there, and the other companies don't have nearly as big a box. I have not done any deep analysis of income tax expense, but and the reason I didn't is there's so many things that can affect income tax expense other than just earnings. You've got bonus depreciation, and that bonus depreciation fluctuates, so it depends on when you put things in as to whether or not you can take bonus depreciation. Production tax credits, I think, are probably a big part of this. NSP tends to enter into purchase power agreements, whereas Otter Tail and MDU are more into owning their wind, though Otter Tail does have a purchase power agreement with Ashtabula as well as owning part of Ashtabula. But for the most part, I think that's a fair statement. And so when you own wind facilities, you get the production tax credits, which reduce income tax expense. If you own purchase power agreements, yes, the purchase power costs are lower because that developer gets to take advantage of the production tax credits, but it tends to then inflate income tax expense on your books compared to the other companies that owned wind. And so while I haven't done a deep analysis of income tax expense, I think that's probably what's causing this. So,
and in the case of the two with the bigger disparity on the last two boxes you've talked about with NSP and Otter Tail, I presume if Otter Tail were able to get their administrative and general costs lowered, they would thus have more tax liability. And so one box would partially offset right. The other one.
Yeah, there's just so much that goes into the income tax calculation. It's not just earnings. It's how you make use of tax deductions and credits and where you build the facilities. In North Dakota, we offer a 10% ITC for these wind farms. And so if you're building them somewhere else, you don't have that credit to taxes. So... Or at least.
Hey, Mike, Brian here. Just a question for anybody out there. How much does it make a difference, like, for the taxes when, now that we've got these, MISOs and SPPs of the world, when companies buy and sell power back and forth into the grid, how does that affect anything what you're talking about today or maybe not at all? I just always was curious where that gets carried in the books.
It's just a part of the cost of providing electricity, whether... And so everybody that has a wind farm, they get production tax credits one way or another, and all of those costs get flowed through to the rate that you can bid into the market. And
so, like, if a company's making money because they have, let's say, we're long on coal or gas or something, and that they need it in the RTO. And the company is, quote, are making money above and beyond what they normally would need. Do they get taxed on that too? I suppose, huh?
The more money you make, the more the government takes.
Fair enough.
Yeah. The last box is customer billing and service. While the boxes are fairly small compared to the rest of them, again, you can see where Otter Tail's is about twice what the other companies are. And so I actually called Otter Tail on this because I thought, how can that be? It can't just be an economy of scale thing. And it wasn't. They still manually read their meters, and they choose to do that. They like to have their people, their system is a little different than NSP. NSP serves three island communities for the most part in North Dakota, whereas Otter Tail serves every three-dog town in North Dakota, or at least the eastern part of North Dakota. And it's just that so it's more spread out, and they like to have their people in the service territory, spread out throughout the service territory, looking at the facilities. They also haven't eliminated a lot of their service centers like a lot of companies have, and they've made a corporate decision to do that. Right now, they're in a position where their rates are the lowest, and they're still doing that, so maybe they can afford to do that. Maybe that is the best way to do business for their operations. It is something that I'm sure they're looking at on a regular basis and thinking, do we need to go to do things the way everyone else is doing them? But there you go. That's a comparison of MDU, NSP, and Otter Tail. Now let's get into the production expense that I said we're going to start getting into the weeds just a little bit on, but I think your pictures may be different than mine a little bit. The unfortunate
looks pretty close.
Okay. The top line, NSP's line, is not quite right. It would be a little lower. The problem with starting to do more and more detailed work and trying to explain variations is you find out things that aren't necessarily true sometimes. And that's the case with this chart. I found out that NSP's line is based on three accounts in FERC, whereas MDU and Otter Tails is just based on one. It's the biggest one, purchase power account 555. The line wouldn't be significantly different. That's why I didn't rush in here and change it. It still would be very similar. It's just the blue line would be lower. In 14, the cost would actually be 6 cents, not close to 7 cents. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to be fair here and state that. So anyway, you can see here that NSP and MDU's rates are similar. The MDU's is lower, but they kind of track in the same manner. And Otter Tails looks crazy. And the reason it looks crazy is they operate an energy department, and they buy and sell and trade energy. They are no longer doing that after 2014, so I expect that Otter Tails' line will start jiving a little closer to NSPs and MDUs. And with that, we're going to get into it more. But one-third of that big production box, is made up of purchase power costs, and we're gonna look at that in more detail in a little bit. About...
Wait, just one second, Mike. One-third, but the 39%, 28%, 30%, that's exactly what
it is,
as a percent of their total power cost.
Production expense, right.
So for Otter Tails, 39% is purchase power?
Right.
Okay.
And hopefully those numbers add up here. so on about two-thirds of the big box production expense is made up of self-generated power costs. And so NSP, of the production expense, their self-generated costs make up 70% of their cost, and MDU 72, and Otter Tails 61%, but about two-thirds. And here you can see that NSP, again, is kind of, they were so tight there. All three companies were very tight through about 2006. You can't even see some of the lines. They were so tight, and then now we're kind of developing a little bit of a crocodile mouth. We've got NSP on the top and Otter Tail on the bottom, and MDU's the tongue, I guess you could say. But okay, now we're going to get to the ugly schedules, and but
so does your ugly schedules get to why? Is that what you're getting at here?
Yep, the ugly schedules are going to start to explain why we're seeing the alligator mouth. I'm going to get my own notes out here. Okay. When you have an ugly schedule like this, I don't think it hurts just to run through the columns a little bit and the lines. But so... we've got the different generating sources, and these are just the major generators for NSP on the top half, Otter Tail on the bottom half. And so NSP's major generating stations include Black Dog, Riverside, Sherburn, or we call it Sherco most of the time, High Bridge, Prairie Island Nuclear, King Coal, Monticello Nuclear, Black Dog Gas, and so then all, and then Otter Tail and MDU for the. I didn't do MDU because MDU and Otter Tail share Begstone and Coyote, so wouldn't see too much difference between MDU and Otter Tail. But in Otter Tail's case, we have Coyote, Begstone, Hoot Lake to some degree, though they're using that less and less, and Minnesota's going to require them to shut that down by 2020, and so that will disappear in the near future. So let's look at NSP's major plants to start with, and let's just look at production expense. If you see under Black Dog 3 and 4, production expense per kilowatt hour is 3.8 cents. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then let's just run across there, and you can just look at the production expense per kilowatt hour for each of their major plants. Riverside is 6 cents. Sherco, their monstrous coal generating facility in Minnesota, 2,500 megawatts, is 3 cents. High Bridge, 5.2 cents. Prairie Island Nuclear, 3.8. King Plant, 3.7. Monticello, 4.9. Black Dog, 5.5 for an average self-generated cost for major generating stations of 3.8 cents. Before we leave NSP, I would like to just look at that utilized capacity a little bit.
Can I ask one quick question about Riverside? What is that? It's not one I've heard about a lot.
Riverside,
is it a peaker?
It was a coal plant that they basically demolished for the most part and converted it to a gas station.
Did it used to be Black Dog 1 and 2 or something?
No.
No? Nope. What was converted? What was the name of the coal plant?
Riverside.
Oh, it was?
Coal, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Dave's on the line. Dave, is that?
Yeah, Riverside is a plant much like High Bridge, both very, very old coal plants that were refurbished, repowered as natural gas combined cycle plants.
Okay.
Thanks, Dave. All right, so now let's look at utilized capacity. So you see Black Dog 3 and 4 again, the first column. It ran 58% of the time. Riverside Gas, 22%. Sherburn, the monster coal facility, ran 52% of the time. High Bridge Gas, 18. Prairie Island Nuclear, 81. King Plant, Coal Plant, 57%. Monticello, 71%. Black Dog Gas, 15. And so on average, their big units ran 52% of the time. Now, there are a few things in there that alarm me a little bit. Generally, coal stations are baseload units and meant to run 70-80% of the time. In the old days, when we weren't so concerned about carbon emission, I believe that I recall days, years, when Coyote was running 80-90% of the time. But when you bid everything into the market and wind is free, there are times when the coal plants, while they are baseload units, the coal plants are having to idle down and accommodate wind. And now we've got solar coming on. That'll have an effect as well. So the other thing I'd like to point out here is nuclear power is not nearly as cheap as it once was. And Fukushima and those kinds of things have caused us to over-regulate, in my opinion, and super-regulate. And that regulation has costs associated with it. You can see that Monticello, just the variable cost, the production expense cost, was a nickel. That is worrisome to me, and we should watch that and pay attention. Then Otter Tail Power.
Is that a reflection of some of the recent investments made there, and or just not? Is that separate?
I mean, they're refurbishing those nuclear plants, and as you probably are aware, the Minnesota environmental community is always in the works trying to close down coal plants, but nuclear plants are not that far behind. They don't much care for nuclear plants either, and so there's going to be pressure in Minnesota to shut down nuclear plants, and there is pressure to shut down nuclear plants. And I'm only pointing this out that we could get into a weird position where nuclear isn't that cheap anymore. We might end up siding with the environmental community if the regulations and the cost of regulations become so onerous that it no longer makes sense to have nuclear facilities. It's crazy sounding, but
if they were running more, wouldn't the costs come down?
Well,
I mean,
in the case of Prairie Island, it ran 80% of the time. Monticello, 71% of the time. So they're running quite a bit. You would expect. I don't have an answer for why Monticello would only be at 71%. Maybe they had to shut down the plant in order to accommodate more environmental upgrades. I don't have an answer for that. But you would expect nuclear to be running for sure 80 plus, maybe close to 90 if you had a good year. So, yeah, the more you run them, the lower the unit cost.
Right.
Okay, so when you explained why those coal plants are running only 50 to 60% of the time, you talked about wind. It's there and free, and so they're backing down. But in between there are these nuclear plants, but Prairie Island is pretty close to coal in price. So I'll emphasize the Monticello one, quite a bit more expensive. Why don't they back that down more and run the coal plants more, yeah, since they're cheaper?
Yeah. it's a good question, and the only answer I have for you is the company bids in their units at cost, at their variable cost, essentially. And so if there are instances where Sherco is not running, even at 3 cents, because presumably wind is coming in at zero. Well, it's always been in at zero. So it's just that it depends on location. You might have more energy needs and there more congestion. You've heard Jerry talk about congestion and things like that. It's bid in, Randy, so that the least cost units run. And so you can't just, I agree with you. If you look at that and you go, 3 cent energy, I'd like all of that and none of Riverside gas.
However, I think that part of this is the nuclear. I mean, I'm not totally sure, but I think the nuclear is closer to a must run than the coal. The coal is easier to back down when you think of, you know, those fuel rods that have to go down into the reactor. It's harder to shut down and back off on nuclear than it is to back down on coal. But the other thing I thought was interesting is if we think about the going forward, and everyone probably sees this as well as I do, you know, when we move to a stronger gas scenario, you're looking at, I mean, and that's what everyone's talking about with the Clean Power Plan, is if we run these gas units more, my goodness, what's going to happen to the cost for customers?
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then a question, and I don't expect a precise answer, but like a ballpark kind of thing. If I look at the three coal plants, their utilized capacity are 58, 52, 57. So let's just say 55 is kind of a average.
On age, or what do we... What?
The utilized capacity
of
the three coal plants.
Okay.
They're running about 55%.
Right.
And I look at Otter Tails that are up in the 70s, while Hoot Lake is low. No. Hoot Lake is lower. But you had mentioned in the old days when some of these coal plants were in the 80s even. So just for picking a number, let's say if they were run 75% instead of 55%, it would seem to me that, yeah, you can save some coal by backing it down, but your employees still want to be paid, and there are other fixed costs. So if they were able to increase their utilized capacity on those three coal plants from about 55% to 75%, what do you suppose that would do to their production expense per kilowatt hour? Would that go from 30 and 38 to 29 and 37, or to would it go down dramatically?
Well, for the most part, I kind of misspoke earlier, I think. For the most part, production expense is a variable cost. So that's what it costs to generate a kilowatt hour of electricity. But to your point, I thought where you were going, Randy, was we have these investments that we've spent billions, hundreds of millions of dollars on. We're running them half the time. In addition to that, the coal miners are sitting out on their scrapers and front-end loaders and sleeping in their cabs because wind is blowing. And so then you have hundreds of millions of other dollars just sitting there idly. It doesn't make sense from a total resource perspective, but we are really kind of looking at what does it cost? What is the variable cost of generating electricity? So if you...
But isn't the variable cost less if you produce 75% of the time instead of 55% of the time?
No, because variable costs are primarily fuel, if you look in there. So the line above the production expense per kilowatt hour is, well, actually I put it in terms of percentages. If you look at the line below, fuel cost as a percent of expense, is, you know, if you look across there, 70, 80s, 84, fuel costs make up most of the production expense. Okay. And so the more kilowatt hours you generate, the more fuel you use. It's a bearable cost of producing electricity. There are some fixed costs, though, because it's not 100%. So to your point, the more electricity you generate, the cheaper it would be, but it's not. We are primarily looking at variable costs here.
Okay.
For that question, if you ran the nuclear plants more, you would have costs go down because their fuel costs are so small.
Yeah, I haven't. I would assume that is true. Yes, 20% of it is fuel costs, as opposed to 88% Black Dog's. So Randy kind of jumped down to Otter Tail. You can scan across there and you see Coyotes producing at 2.5 cents, Big Stone a little less than 3 cents. Overall, it's 3.1 cents for Otter Tail because they've got Hoot Lake factored in there and the utilized capacity. Average capacity of their three main plants, coal plants, is 68%.
Okay.
All right. Moving, Dave, did you have some comments at all?
Well, the only comment I would make around running the baseload plants more is that with the thousands of megawatts now of wind that we have, we shouldn't forget that the variable cost of wind is basically zero. So if we were to run these baseload plants more at their 3 cents a kilowatt hour, we'd actually, we would lower the overall costs of those particular units, but we would be charging customers more because we'd be generating more cost. So just to keep that in mind, that we have a list here of plants, but it's certainly not the whole fleet, including the very low variable cost wind facilities.
Before thanks, Dave. Before I move on to the next slide, I would like to also draw your attention to the age of the last units installed there. If you look across there, you know, you see some fairly young plants for NSP. Riverside's new. Highbridge is new. For the most part, the King plant is new, though they haven't it shows up as a 48-year-old plant, but for the most part, they refurbished that plant entirely, so that one's fairly new. They're working to upgrade, update. They have updated Monticello and where's that?
Prairie Island.
Prairie Island. So the reason that we see some price variation between Otter Tail and MDU and NSP to a large degree is they're in a different place in the investment cycle than Otter Tail and MDU is. For instance, I could offer this. Otter Tail has told me that when they bring their gas plant online, that will add about 6/10 of a 6/10 of a cent to an average bill. And so when we're looking at a overall price difference of whatever it was, 1.5 cents in the earlier slides, 6/10 of a cent is pretty significant. And so we can expect that for Otter Tail in the future. I believe MDU is probably still looking at building some kind of gas plant, combined cycle unit. But okay, the next one. Dave, did you get the new slide with the purchase power costs?
I'm not sure if I have everything you're showing. Trying to follow along on the on the web.
Oh, it's up on the web. Oh, okay. Thanks, Steve. It's kind of hard to see, isn't it, Dave?
A little bit.
Okay. I did this late yesterday because I wanted to beef up the explanation of why NSP's costs, purchase power costs, are higher than Otter Tail and MDU. And right away, well, some big takeaways. That type, I've got some explanations of what OS, LU, and SF mean. But generally, I'll just say this. NSP prefers to enter into long-term purchase power agreements more than buying energy off of the MISO energy market. For instance, in 2014, MDU, if I had MDU up here to compare, their MISO energy market percentage would be 90%. 90% of all purchase power costs came through the MISO energy market. NSP's was 31%, I think. Oh, it should be up there somewhere. Where is it? Help me.
Some NSP supplier, the line right in the middle. First
line. Oh, yeah, yeah.
31%.
Yep, 31%. And Otter Tail's at 51%. We know that the MISO energy market has been very cheap for many years now, since basically the bottom fell out of the market back in 2008. And so they're buying off the market, whereas MDU's entering, or NSP tends to enter into long-term contracts. So let's just look at Otter Tail, and then we'll look at NSP. Otter Tail's is very...
Hey, Julie?
Yeah.
I got to just so you guys know, I got another 10 o'clock call I got to drop off and get on. So I didn't really have any other questions, but I just appreciate the dialogue.
Okay. Thanks, Brian.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Otter Tails is fairly simple in that most of their purchase power costs come from MISO, 51% of it, and that average cost. Oh, before we start going, let me explain a little more. We have two costs per kilowatt hour up there, right? The first one is if I take total purchase power cost divided by megawatt hours, I get a cost per kilowatt hour. But since NSP is entering into long-term contracts and buying capacity along with energy, it's important to segregate that out. And let's just look at the FAR column, which is energy cost only, so that we're comparing apples to apples.
That doesn't include the capacity.
It doesn't include capacity costs. So you can see that Otter Tail's average cost of energy purchased is 2.8 cents. NSP's average cost of energy purchased is 4.65 cents. One thing I need to point out is the very next item on Otter Tails is something called RBC Capital Markets. It's a big negative cost and tons of megawatt hours. And when I first saw that, I thought, oh, my goodness, they must hit the jackpot there. People are paying them to take their win. No, that's not what's going on here, and I would have loved to adjust this, but I found out just this morning. Had a call into Otter Tail to get an explanation. But what's going on there is 2014 was the last year their energy department was busy trading electricity. And so this is kind of a way to account for the trading business that was going on at Otter Tail Corporation. And so, to be fair, I would scratch this line and adjust that 2.82 cents to 3.68. I just scratch out 2.82, and I draw a line through the RBC Capital Markets. So the average cost for Otter Tail's purchase power costs really is 3.68 cents. We don't expect to see this kind of craziness from Otter Tail in 2015 because their energy department no longer trades energy. So then it's 3.68 versus 4.65. Okay. So the difference isn't nearly as great as I thought initially. Now, so if you want to just look down the cost per kilowatt hour, just for the fun of it, and run your finger down there, you see about three that made the list anyway. You see biomass facilities, Fibromin at 15 cents a kilowatt hour, Laurentian Energy at 12 cents a kilowatt hour, and St. Paul Cogen at 15 cents a kilowatt hour. I didn't want to put that in there because our last settlement agreement agreed to pay for those costs. It was part of a settlement agreement. I still don't like writing it down and having to answer it every time, but the rationale simply was that they were required to build those so that they could operate their nuclear plants to a large degree, and we like their nuclear plants, and we like their nuclear energy and capacity, and so in the settlement agreement, we agreed to take that as long as they would get generation built in North Dakota and as long as, what were some of the other, and the other factor that entered into my mind when we were negotiating that was these contracts will be gone within 10 years, and so we, which sounds like a long time, but in a generating cycle, it's not that long. And some of them will be dropping off within, as I recall, 4 or 5 years. So it's not, we won't have to plug our noses for too long on those units.
When you look at, they don't purchase all that much. Are they required to purchase a certain amount or everything that's generated, or how does that work?
Well, generally when you have long-term agreements, you have a fixed price and you're going to take whatever is generated.
Okay. And then the Manitoba
I just say if you don't take what's generated, normally the contract would require you to pay for it anyway. But
yeah. And the Manitoba Hydro, which is pretty affordable,
right,
that may or may not be renewed.
Right.
Somehow or another, as we discussed it, I got more focused on the far right columns.
Right.
But isn't the total cost what our consumers actually have to pay? We can focus on those three that are double digits, but I look down just below the bottom of those three, the next one down, that shows only 5.15 excluding capacity. But I come over here and it's 36, the capacity, and it's $50 million is the bottom line to me. And I don't want to miss that kind of thing. That's one of the biggest total costs that they have here. And you look down that right column and it comes in at a 5.15, it's easy to miss.
It is. I don't. I know Dave hasn't had a chance to. I haven't asked Dave this question yet, and so Dave, here comes one you probably can't answer. But one of my big concerns here, Randy, is that we've got 200. If you look at the difference between $830 million total cost, $640 million energy cost, you've got almost $200 million then that's being paid for capacity. We know they're long on capacity already. The commission, for that fact, disallowed some units for cost recovery. And so it certainly does make me wonder, are these demand costs being considered in the integrated resource plan? I don't remember that being included in the integrated resource plan. So if they're long with their own units and you're buying more capacity, I'm not sure I understand it. And so, Dave, I know this is catching you cold, but do you have any comments on that?
Sure. Well,
one quick thing while you do that, could you just tell us what is LSP Cottage Grove? That's the one that Randy was asking about. What kind of a facility is that? In addition to answering Mike's question.
I believe LSP is a biomass PPA. I don't have any other details on that, but I'll look into it. Certainly, all of the purchase power arrangements are, in fact, considered in our resource plan and in the development of our load and resource table. So they are included in the total mix that we use when we plan for the system.
Great, Dave. I just didn't remember seeing them, and I didn't have time to go back and look, and so thanks a lot for that.
Yeah, I don't think they're probably detailed. They're probably grouped into a PPA line somewhere in there.
Okay. Thank you. I guess the one takeaway, and I'm sure you guys have already got the takeaway that I'd like you to come away with, is we need to continue to be very careful in analyzing what NSP is doing as far as purchase power contracts go and as far as the kinds of units they're building. It has an impact on the customers, and it's showing itself more and more every year. And so I say that because sometimes I get the sense when NSP comes here and talks to staff and maybe the commission as well that, okay, we've reached these agreements. Now North Dakota's finally happy and we can do whatever we want. I'm exaggerating, Dave. Don't overreact. But as long as this company moves away from least cost planning, we need to be on top of our game, or we will find ourselves in very bad position. And we've already, I mean, to some degree, it's already happened. Our rates in North Dakota, NSP's rates in North Dakota, you saw them compared to the other two companies. We've done what we could to battle back, but it's...
Mike, isn't that the part of the rationale for requiring them to come in here for ADPs for anything over, what was it, 50 megawatts?
Well, it's too bad Brian dropped off because I'm not sure where Brian talks sometimes about not wanting ADPs. I love...
Well, and Randy does too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, don't want them.
Yeah.
I like ADPs because of things like this. It allows you to look at one unit and make sure that that is really least cost and that we want to pass those costs on to customers. I like the focus that we get with ADPs. I understand why. I mean, it's a lot of work for me, and it's a lot of work for the commissioners to listen to those hearings and render decisions, but I think they're valuable myself, but it sounds like I'm swimming upstream a little bit.
Well, I agree with you, and it goes back to our first case with them where there were all these, you know, individually small contracts that collectively added up to $5 million worth of costs for North Dakota customers. And it seemed like that was the rationale for we got to review these so that they don't slip in and become part of a bigger rate case where it isn't enough of a deal to decline that specific small cost. And then, but over time, it gets to the point where it's too much, and you've already allowed the costs. So I tend to agree that it's better to do the ADPs.
Well, I don't know the age of a lot of these contracts, but it almost seems like about, and I recognize there are other variables, but it seems like these costs have been, if we look back to the first charts, going out of control about the same time as they started having ADPs.
Well, the ADPs were required in 2020. That first rate case is when we required it.
No, but I mean, we made available the option of coming in for ADPs, what, you know, 10, 12 years ago, for whatever it was, 15. And about then is when it doesn't seem like it's been working all that well.
Well, of course, the public utilities generally have an easier time of passing legislation than the PSC and the common man. and so, of course, ADPs were brought about by the utility industry. And I mean, that was their push, and they got that legislation, and for good reason. They could see that investments were going to come along, and they wanted to limit their risk. If we can get the commission to approve a plan ahead of time, rather than spend $1 billion and then come in later and go, please, now can we recover our costs? To me, it makes sense that you want to be involved in earlier rather than later. Once they've spent it, that's tough to deny it later. Not that you couldn't, but it's much easier to be, in my mind, to deal with it when they're making a decision, because one, you know about, you have some context for what you're looking at. You know what the cost of natural gas is. You know what the cost of market energy is.
Sorry.
When you delay that, perhaps 5 years till the next rate case, and then try to revisit that, you've lost context for the period when that decision was being made. And so I strongly encourage the commission to continue to look at least the large units when the decision is being made, as opposed to later and second guessing later. Why not hear the facts, make a decision based in the context of what's going on at the time, and live with your decision. You shouldn't, you know, it's one thing I do see a little bit. If I'm, I do work for the commission, and so maybe I'm overstepping my bounds here, but sometimes I get the feeling the commission would like to have their cake and eat it too, and that's, I don't know that that's really fair. I think the commission should look at the facts at the time the decision's being made and agree or disagree and live with the decision. But
Mike, if we hadn't had that requirement on the latest solar projects, they may have chosen not to ask us ahead of time, gone ahead, built them, come back in the next rate case, which would have been in 20, since we don't have one, 2018, and then it's already up and operational, perhaps. I don't know what the timeline was, but it may have been a lot more difficult for us to say no to that at that point versus just on the front end saying this doesn't fit with how we think you should be planning your system and incorporating new generation, and so you can't charge North Dakota customers for this.
Right.
At this time.
On the other side of having your cake and eating it too, though, is this Mankato one that you guys have, I'm never sure which words to use, not really denied, but you've
Dismissed
without prejudice. The nice thing about that, I guess, is that maybe that cost will come in line. Let's say the economy heats up, and so if that's the case, and energy prices go up, and Mankato all of a sudden is in the money, NSP will be able to recover their costs, their North Dakota costs, from North Dakotans five, six years later. I understand it. I hope my comments
keep moving
make
on.
Sense to you.
Yep.
All right. The last three slides we can just blast through pretty quickly. The bolded lines are the ones that I want you to pay attention to. The actual returns on equity earned by NSP have been around that between 8.79 and 10.8%, 10.08%, which is fairly reasonable, maybe on the low side for an electric company. If I use the return on equity authorized by the commission for each of those years, the company under-earned about $3 to $4 million in 11, 12, and 14, and over-earned by $1 million in 2013. The next slide is rate base slide. It just shows you all the different components of rate base, plant and service, accumulated depreciation, accumulated deferred income taxes being the primary accounts. You look across the very first line, plant and service has grown about $250 million in 3 years. And that's just North Dakota. Average rate base has grown about half that, and the reason that is, of course, is all the tax advantages of late, the bonus depreciation and production tax credits and the such. And so while it's grown about $250 million, the investment that customers have to pay on has only increased about half. $125 million, approximately. The next slide is a good news story. Cost of capital just keeps going down. The companies, all three of them, this is NSP's, but all three of them, I don't think, sorry, I'm not, have similar stories. Cost of long-term debt in 2011 was 6.12%. In 14, it's 4.89%. They've refinanced their debt at lower costs. Short-term interest used primarily during construction activities is less than 1%. Common equity, again, is just what the authorized ROE is based on commission orders. And so the overall cost of capital in 2014 is 7.52%, literally unheard of in the last 30 years. But the last one is net operating income.
Back to that one, yes. Really quick. Does that suggest that it's smart for them to be making these investments now versus Otter Tail and MDU that and
is,
that sort of thing?
That is the bright side of making all of these investments today, is the cost of long-term debt is cheap, and it's even cheaper when you figure that you can deduct interest expense for tax purposes. So there is that does make the case for investing now. Yep.
How close should the how should rate of return track with long-term debt costs?
Depends on which economist you talk to, probably. I'm not an economist, but
he's an accountant.
He's my economist for the moment.
Yeah. So let's say interest rates are 1%. We should just give them 5% ROE. There's a breakdown, I think, and I don't know that you can just simply add four percentage points to the Treasury rate, or when the Treasury rate is nothing. That's why I hire economists to represent staff on cost of capital. I'm not that strong in that area, but just from my 30 years of experience, it's not just a simple add-on to the Treasury rate. It's more than that.
But as these interest rates have dropped and stayed low for a pretty long period of time, do you think the commission over the years has been recognizing that and that we're where we ought to be on our rates of return, or have we been overly generous and not really recognizing the low cost of borrowing?
Yeah. Well, we capture all of their lower long-term debt costs in rate cases, so we get the benefit of all of the lower cost of debt. But on the return on equity, about all I can say to that question, Randy, is we do look at the annual ROEs authorized by 51 states across the country, and we tend to be in the middle, not in the bottom and not on the top, but towards what I would say the average ROE granted is. So let's say you have a company that maybe is losing its way a little bit as far as watching out after the consumers, and their costs are getting higher and higher, and they're not able to compete with the other entities within our state. Is that a mechanism that the commission, is that something the commission should consider and authorize a lower ROE for that company? Or let's say we think that management's really not making management decisions for the company, but the environmentalists and the Minnesota Public Utility Commission and the wonks over at DOC are making the management decisions. Should we pay management incentives, compensation? I mean, that's why I bolded that paragraph. I know it sounds mean-spirited and NSP feels like I'm being mean right now. I'm not being mean. I think it's part of the tools in your hands to deal with things.
Thanks. I think, Randy, I've looked at some charts, and kind of over time, I think I know what you're kind of getting at. The rates of return that are authorized by this commission and other commissions, so interest rates change kind of sharply.
I said other commissions, I mean not just the last 3 years. I didn't mean around the country, but not just the last 3 years, but mm-hmm. over 10, 15.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. You know, over time, the authorized rates of return, it kind of tends to follow that, but much more of a gradual slope. You know, so interest rates will come down, and slowly the rates of return authorized will start to come down, and then when they go back up, it's kind of a similar. It's a much more smooth trend than actual interest rates.
Thanks, Vic. That's very good.
Okay.
That is it, folks.
Great. Well, that was very helpful.
Oh, that is nice.
I do appreciate the discussion. I like this kind of informal talk that an analysis that is outside of the rate cases, because it does help provide a base of knowledge that you can build on outside of rate cases, and then you're more prepared for the complicated analysis that occurs in a rate case. So I don't have any more questions. Do you, Randy?
I've marked one tab. I'll be coming by next week or something.
Great.
But it's longer.
Okay.
What do I want to get into today?
Okay.
I also appreciate that this has been a helpful hour and a half.
Okay. And I also very much appreciate the conclusion you reached in your memo and the bolded paragraph, because I agree that, I mean, we have a job to do here. It isn't a rubber stamp. And when we see trends that are troubling, it's our responsibility to use whatever tools we have to try to push things in a different direction than we think is more appropriate. So thank you for that and for the thoughts on how we need to be engaging in this longer term. So
you have something there. I don't have.
This you got a while ago.
Oh, okay. That.
So now I would assume this will go on to the agenda.
Nope. We are actually, we closed the cases.
Oh, we did?
Last meeting, but it was on consent, so you wouldn't have noticed it necessarily. I think that was the direction that I was given in a earlier discussion, that let's close the cases and then talk about them. So that's what we did.
Hmm.
It's a little backwards, but
that was not the direction I anticipated.
Okay. Well, that's the problem with serving three commissioners. Yeah. Sometimes I get my wires, or I don't know if I get my wires confused or if I get getting multiple.
No, I think the portfolio holder in this case trumped.
What's that?
The portfolio holder in this case trumped me,
oh, yeah.
And I didn't catch it on the consent agenda. So, anyway, so it goes. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.